Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solaria Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm supposed to be on holiday, but it's a working holiday. I'm in Switzerland, and I'm here with Pete Kennedy, host of the Solaria Food Series and wonderful founder and attorney of the Farm-to-Consumer Legal Defense Fund, who has done more than just about anybody to educate me to food in America. And Pete and I have talked for many years about how do we help the state legislators start to effect really powerful change. And, you know, the conditions are finally coming together for that to happen. So in the second quarter wrap-up, we had a little piece that Franklin Sanders wrote on things that the state legislature could do to improve financial liquidity. And I had asked Pete to put together, which he did, a wonderful checklist of things we could do in the food area. And we sent them both in to a variety of places. But I said, Pete, you know, redundancy works here. We need to do a recording where we talk through all the things that state legislatures can do in the food and financial worlds to really rebuild local economies and create the conditions of sovereignty. And so Pete and I talked back and forth, and we decided, okay, you know, we keep trying to get people to, you know, try to keep the foodies to understand the money and the finance guys to understand the food. And so we thought, okay, we'll go back and forth between food and finance. So this is an experiment, right, Pete?
I'm ready.
So, well, first of all, I just want to thank you for, you know, if you look at all the things you have done for, I don't know, as long as I, for many, many years to improve local food systems, I don't think there's anybody who's done more in terms of making an effort and going right at the heart of the issue. So before we start, I just want to thank you. And thank you for being the host of the Solaria Food Series, because I know you're a little skeptical.
Well, it's an honor to work for you, honor to work for Solaria. And yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Okay, well, you're great. Okay, so we're going to start, and you're the guest this time, so I'm going to ask you to begin. If we're going to make suggestions to our state legislatures, if we're going to support them, what's the first thing a state legislature can do in the food area? What's your top pick?
Well, you talk about decentralization quite a bit. And I think that's definitely the direction you have to move. And also deregulation with local food producers. I mean, there are several areas in the local food sector that where the legislators can really help out by taking off as many of the regulatory shackles as possible. Just one of the areas that has really made a lot of progress in local food is cottage foods. And that's where just the basic definition of cottage foods is foods that aren't subject to time and temperature control. You don't have to refrigerate them. You know, baked goods, jams, jellies, even some of the fermented foods, sauerkraut, pickles, can all go under cottage food. And right. And everyone has a cottage foods law right now. It's just a question of expanding it. Actually, Tennessee, your home state, passed a great law this last year, so it's expanding out. Another area, you know, I can get into more detail later if you want. Another area would be raw milk. Just the conventional dairy industry has collapsed in this country. 50 years ago, there were over 500,000 dairies. Today, there are about 30,000. And what is increasing in the dairy sector is the number of raw milk producers, number of raw milk consumers out there. Right. And it's an interesting food. It's the only food that's banned in interstate commerce. But in a way, it's turned out to be a blessing because the states usually rely on the federal regulations for a particular food to set their own laws. Now they can just do whatever they want. There's no federal pressure. It's a real hodgepodge of laws. And most of the states right now have allowed raw milk distribution and or sales in some way. Okay, then there are a couple areas that are subject to the Federal Meat Inspection Act, the Federal Poultry Products Act, where basically what the state can do, the federal government provides exemptions in these areas from inspection, meaning an inspector doesn't have to be present when meat animals are being slaughtered. With poultry, there's an exemption where they can process up to 20,000 birds a year. A farmer can process up to 20,000 birds a year without an inspector being present on the farm. And in a state, again, like Tennessee, that's worked really well. And again, most states have done that. And with meat, it's the same thing. There are exemptions where you don't have to have an inspector present. There's a custom exemption. And also there's even an on-farm exemption, which is a little controversial right now, but again, I can talk about it later if you want.
So, you know, I'll never forget coming back from the course that I took at Joel Salatin's farm, and where, you know, he's processing chickens and he's processing rabbits on the farm, and it's a great cash flow business. I mean, he's making a great business for himself and his family, because he can process the chickens on his farm. He's got this great, you know, the tractor operation. So I got into a huge fight with wonderful ally Rob Kirby, who was very concerned about what was happening with interest rate swaps in the derivative market. He's talking about this big global financial system. And he says, now, how can you possibly think that processing 20,000 chickens is more important than derivatives and interest rate swaps? And I said, because if, you know, every family who can process 20,000 chickens, that's a profitable family who can be independent, and you get enough of them and those cash flows are going to cascade up. And it was sort of, you know, the difference about looking at things on a global basis versus looking at things on a decentralized basis. And it was one of my first clues to, you know, the my commitment, I'm going to get the foodies and the finance people to talk one language.
Well, right. I think that poultry exemption is maybe the local food equivalent of the GI Bill.
Absolutely. Great. That is a great description. I'm going to use that. Yes.
Right. Because it's just something where they got this one right, and just thousands and thousands of farmers have benefited from it. And, right. You know, the just the regulators or the fear mongers, what they'll say, well, without an inspection, without an inspector being present, the risks of harm go up. And it, with the food, with this poultry exemption, the number of illnesses in over the 50 years that they've been had it, of few, if any. It's just, It's been a great success.
Well, it's the chickens, but I remember Sally Fallon from Weston Price giving this wonderful speech where she described the economics of a dairy farmer being able to do raw milk and sell it to their neighbors. You know,
right.
And in both the raw milk and the chicken, you're talking about very high quality food that can create real, serious, meaningful jobs producing quality food. And it's making local food economic.
Right. And what's kind of happened with raw milk is the value added is where the money is at. And in a lot of states, just raw milk is legal. But there are other states where they're starting to add other raw milk products.
Right.
For instance, I knew one farmer who was selling milk at $5 a gallon at one time, but was selling, could turn that into 4 quarts of yogurt and was getting $5 a quart. So $20. So big potential there.
Big difference. Okay. So can I dive into a money one?
Okay. I'll do my best. Sure.
So one of the first things we suggested to create the conditions of sovereignty that would allow a state to build local financial markets or improve the local financial markets. One was a state bank, and I would marry it with a state depository. So everyone knows the example of the North Dakota has a state bank that's essentially a wholesale bank to the local banks. And I think a state bank provides a lot of benefits to a state, including being a depository of the state, so they don't have to use the New York Fed banks, who have serious conflicts of interest. A state bank can provide real protection to the local banks from some of the games that go on at the federal level, including at the central bank. So a state bank has been very successful from what we know in North Dakota. I would marry it with a state depository because I think it's very important that a state and its citizens be able to deposit gold and silver reasonably close to home. And we've seen Texas create a state depository. This makes it much more feasible for the state pension funds and different state financial, like the Rainy Day Reserve Fund, to buy and hold bullion, precious metals bullion, within the state. And of course, the state has the authority to use the state militia and other enforcement capability to protect it. So to me, number one thing you want to do is have a state bank that's wholesale. It's not, you know, it's not banking with the citizens. I think that would be a terrible idea, but it's really supporting the local state, the local banks, the local community banks, the local credit unions, and really helping them stay healthy and independent, and then a state depository so they can start to integrate precious metals in very powerful ways.
Okay. So question for you is, when you're trying to sell a legislator on that, what do you tell them that the state can do with a state bank that they can't do right now? Just what specifics?
So a state bank, and it depends on how they do it, but a state bank can function as a custodian and a depository to the state government that can keep it away and protect it from using some of the bigger private banks. So it can provide less corrupt mechanism, protecting the state, protecting their data, protecting their banking operations. You know, one of the problems the federal government has, and the reason $21 trillion is missing, you know, is they were dependent on, as a depository, on the New York Fed member banks. And look what happened. So that's one. But I think what the state bank can be a wholesale lender and provide a variety of support functions to the local banks. And that can help protect them against central bank shenanigans.
Okay. What about as far as making just more money available for agriculture infrastructure, or helping just the state government being able to target more programs that would help small farmers and, yeah, local food consumers within the state?
I think the thing the state can most do to help the local farmers, you know, because if you have a healthy infrastructure of community banks and credit unions, there's going to be plenty of credit on the ground, so long as you reduce the risk of regulatory sort of torture and interference and create the conditions of profitability. So what farmers need is profit. So if you can do the kind of regulatory relief you're describing, whether it's processing 20,000 chickens or, you know, doing raw milk, then farmers are back in the game. If we want the state to help also improve profitability beyond that, look at the state contracting and state-related institutional contracting budget. So all the schools, all the state hospitals, all the different state facilities, are they buying their food from big corporate contractors? Or are they buying their food locally?
So right.
As much as possible, you want to swing those purchases either to local farmers within the state or to farmers in the states around you where you have regional compacts. So I'll get into regional compacts in a second, but I think you want to bring the food much closer to home, dramatically lowering transportation costs and making sure that there's much higher quality by sort of feeding the small farms.
So here's a problem that's come up right now with the school lunch program. And it's that they get the federal funding, I don't know, millions of a year, maybe each district, but as a condition of that funding, they cannot serve whole milk in the school lunch program.
Right. So we'll fund your food as long as you poison your kids.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, but how is, say, a state bank? Yeah. How do you create the just liquidity in the state so they can tell the federal government to they're not relying on the federal government for right. that for that money.
So we need to talk about taxes, and I don't want to do it now. I want to get to towards the end. But what I would say is you want to create far more conditions of profitability in the local school district, at which point the local school district can afford, you know, to pay for private food, which may be more expensive without the federal subsidy. But the federal subsidy is basically paying you to do something that makes the kids less healthy. And so
right.
you're going to have to wean your way off. But the way you wean your way off is to go to, you know, the equivalent of a cash model where people are willing to pay what they're, you know, for the quality they need. That's only going to happen if you create the conditions of profitability within the place.
Okay. Just one of the things I notice on the food sector is you have these cooperative agreements between a federal government agency and a state government agency. And it just enables the state agency in a way to do an end around on the legislature. You know, so I'm not as familiar with how it would work in healthcare or education,
right.
But in agriculture, the FDA has some responsibility, say, under the Food Safety Modernization uh-huh. Act. They hire the state to carry out some of those responsibilities. You know, it's initial infusion of cash for the state, but just for some of the cooperative agreements I've seen, it really doesn't work all that well. I mean, they wind up spending more money than they take in.
Right.
And they're just stuck with the... Yeah, carrying out the federal dictates.
Okay, so let me give you two examples that, you know, that sort of describe this problem. When I've interviewed Chuck Morone of Strongtowns twice on the Solari Report. And in the little video short that we did for the first one, we talk about a study he did for a town. He was a municipal engineer. A study he did for a town in Louisiana. The town had taken in over the previous several decades huge amounts of federal grants and built up a lot of infrastructure using federal grants. And he calculated that the average home in that town spent $1,500 a year for real estate taxes. But if they were going to properly maintain all the infrastructure that they had built over the last couple of decades using federal grants, they would have to raise their real estate taxes to an average of $8,500 per home. Exactly. And what that meant was, as a practical matter, the only way to deal with the situation was to just start letting things deteriorate. And he said, you know, the thing you need to understand about Detroit is they're just ahead. All over America, you have fantastic amounts of federally funded infrastructure. And if you look at the long-term cost of it, you know, it's going to bankrupt all these towns and they're just going to have to let it go. So,
right.
So it's the same kind of problem. You have the federal subsidy so far ahead. You know, the federal subsidy is doing a series of things that destroys the local economy, and then the local economy can't support what the subsidy builds in that place. You know, it's, you get completely out of balance. It achieves central control, but it destroys the economy. And so what the state legislatures that you're talking about doing are grappling. It's like getting a body out of addiction. How are you going to get out of the addiction of the federal money? Now, let me suggest one idea I tried to use in the Bush administration. They're called jumbo waivers, where a local area, New Jersey did this, I think, under Tom Kane in the healthcare area, go to the federal government. They take a look at all the money the feds are putting in and what it's getting spent on. And they say, okay, we want to do something much more flexible with the money. And we are proposing, this list, this 100 pages of different rules we can get relief from. And under these performance metrics, you agree to sign a jumbo waiver where we're relieved of this 100 pages of stuff as long as we achieve this, this, and this. It was called a jumbo waiver. And it had been initially done in the healthcare area, but I was proposing we do it in housing and community development as well as health. Anyway, I didn't get it done. But one of the reasons I was doing the GIS software to show the sources and uses of all government money in a place was to show how you could re-engineer it one place at a time, among other things, using jumbo waivers to create dramatically more wealth.
Right. So, yeah, I think it's just this dependence on the federal money. It just seems to be a huge roadblock.
Okay, so let me just tell a story I told Whitney. In 1996, my company had been doing due diligence on housing, foreclosed housing in the FHA inventory in cities all over the country. And I took the data on three cities. One was Chicago, one was New Orleans, and one was Los Angeles. And I had dinner with an assistant who worked in the public housing program at HUD. And I said, look, you guys are spending $250,000 per unit to build or reconstruct public housing when $50,000 would buy and rehab a single family property in the foreclosed property inventory in the same four block area. So we could get four or five homes for the price of one. And she turned bright red and she said, but how would we generate fees for our friends? So the money that's being spent by the federal government, that's saying they can't have whole milk, that's not being spent to help. That's being spent to control.
Right. And it's trying to break out of the control. Just well, so say you have a state bank,
Right.
and so we're talking, there's so many things you can do to improve the infrastructure of local food. You can give grants or loans to start up dairy plants. Right now, there's a real shortage of dairy plants in the so many areas of the country. They're controlled by Dairy Farmers of America, which just has a monopoly on them. You can there's a shortage of abattoirs in most states, just not enough slaughterhouses to make the meet the demand for local meat. Grain mills, yeah, just funding people to put up greenhouses. So from what you're saying, that money wouldn't come from the state bank.
There is enough money on the private side that could leave the stock market or the real estate and fund all that stuff in the private markets if the investors believe that it was safe. They're not afraid of taking business risk, but what they're afraid of is, starting a local farm business or food business and having the regulators come in and destroy it so that the big companies, can control the market. In other words, the risk they don't want to invest up against is the political risk of central control coming top down and using regulation and state contracts and other government mechanisms. So they don't want to invest in a business that a corrupt government is going to destroy.
Right. And that, you've talked about the attorney generals, getting the attorney generals together and just fighting back against this centralization. I mean, one example in the food area I can think of is there are two kinds of meat inspection programs. There's a state meat inspection program and a federal meat inspection program. And the state meat inspection programs, their laws have to be at least as strict as the federal.
Right.
But given that they have the same laws, but with a state meat inspection program, you can only sell in inner in intrastate commerce, a meat from a state inspected facility, when you still have to follow the same laws as a federally inspected. So maybe this is an area the attorney generals could get together and fight back. There was actually an interstate meat compact started up. Montana was a signatory to it, maybe South Dakota, where they were going to sell state inspected meat from Montana to say South Dakota or other members of the compact, but they can't do that right now with the way the law is.
Yeah, so if they get together and fight back on that, remember, the private markets, when I tell you there's more money than you can imagine searching for legitimate investments. So what the centralization and the central control is doing is destroying the profit of small farms and local markets. What we need to do is stop destroying the profit, and the private market will finance a huge amount. I'm not saying, you know, we might not want to get the state involved in financing, but what we need to do, you know, the investors need two things. They need farmers allowed to be profitable. They need neighbors allowed to buy food, and they need, you know, to be protected. They need the rule of law. They can't function without the rule of law. And
right.
And what they've got right now is the Sheriff of Nottingham. And what we need the states to do is not put more money to start things in. We need the state to protect the things we start from the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Right. Just what in the food area, one of the problems is, and this happened with meat 60 years ago, where it was a competitive industry. The Congress passed the Wholesome Meat Act, and what you had as a result is it became much more expensive to operate a local slaughterhouse, and it just consolidated the industry to where you have something like four companies controlling 85%
right.
of the meat packing today. What's going on? So USDA has the meat. I mean, that's what they regulate. About 80% of the food supply is regulated by FDA. And with this Food Safety Modernization Act, that was just, it's been slow developing, but potentially you're looking at another way to consolidate control within fewer right. corporations. Right now, there's a rule that FDA will probably be issuing this fall, a final rule. They call it their traceability rule. And it's just going to put up so many requirements for these smaller producers that eventually there could be a problem with the cost of compliance.
There's a huge cost of compliance now. If you look at the cost of compliance on any small business in America, and small farms are, it's the worst. And a lot of that data collection is invasive and not designed to help either the local, you know, the local food purchaser or the local farmer.
Right. And what I've seen, what Weston Price has sent me to this International Association for Food Protection Conference, uh-huh. the biggest food safety conference in the world. And it's like I mentioned with the poultry earlier, the big argument against unregulated local food is, yeah, without having the inspector, there's a greater risk of harm. And just what I saw when I was at that conference, the regulators there just have a thankless job. There might be a foodborne illness outbreak with a food that has ingredients coming from a dozen different countries. So what local food has by far over the industrial system is traceability, just what this law is supposed to be addressing. And, you know, just the regulators and the industry are together. They won't look at the obvious solution, which is decentralization and deregulation of locally produced food.
Uh-huh.
So the question is, with them not doing that, how do you strike back? What are the ways to effectively move forward just with continued deregulation?
So this is tricky because I don't think traceability buys you anything in terms of safety.
Right.
In other words, an industrialized system of the kind we have Basically, what we've proven, it has low to zero integrity. And traceability isn't going to solve that.
Right.
Now, it sounds great, and it gives everybody very invasive data and control that they can use to control the market, but it doesn't solve any of the problems. And I think part of what has to happen is we have to find a way of describing what are the conditions of health that do create a healthy food system, a nutritious food system, and how does that relate to the money that we're spending on healthcare?
Right. Well, right. So something like, I think it's something like 17% of our GMP goes to healthcare, which to me is a very unproductive, yes, part of the GMP.
Right.
So what we've seen at Weston Price is occasionally you get people there who've been eating all this locally produced food, going direct to the farm, going direct to local artisans, who are having, who had health problems at one time. Now they're better. I mean, occasionally you get some really miracle stories, but for the most part, it's the people on this diet. They don't go to doctors nearly as much. They don't take nearly as much medication, so they're a much less of a burden on the healthcare system and free up money to be spent in more productive ways.
Right. So what I've seen, I don't know if you, Jeffrey Smith used to sell it on his website. It was the story of a community, I think it was in Wisconsin, where they changed the school system from the corporate food to local fresh food. And then they tracked what happens to kids' behavior. The behavioral problems crashed. You know, it just went like this. The health problems crashed. You know, all the kids' grades started to, you know, get much better. And on any reasonable performance, you know, metrics of intellectual performance, physical performance in sports, you know, health, everything, the kids were significantly improved.
Now, right.
If you're a state legislator and you say, well, that costs 10% more, you know, or the conversion out of the corporation costs 10% more, you know, what I have to say is, why do we have schools? You know, schools are there to educate children. If you put children in a school, poison them, and they don't get a good education, what's the point?
Yeah, and just what you see is these corporations like Coke and Pepsi enter into contracts direct with the school districts.
Right.
Where they pay them money to put the soda machines in there.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just trying to figure out how to get as far removed from the federal money and be dependent on that, which when you brought up the state bank, I guess.
So let me give you an example of getting away from the federal money. If you look at the conditions that come with federal money, both upfront and over time, the project always costs more, and the conditions over time ultimately end up the way I told the story in Louisiana, bankrupting you. So I'll give you an example. I tried to stop my town in Tennessee from building a walking path.
Right.
So I'm going to tell you the story of the Hickory Valley walking path. The Hickory Valley walking path, there were three people who walked regularly in Hickory Valley. One was me, and another was another person on the Soleri team who you know, and then a third neighbor. And we walked on the road. And the road had a lot of potholes and needed fixing, right? So I think it was the local development authority in Jackson came to the town and approached them and wanted them to get a $180,000 grant to build a walking path. Now, if you look at all the great kids there who could afford, you know, who need help with scholarships to go to college, you know, or to get an education, I would say spending $180,000 on a walking path is a completely ridiculous investment compared to other things we could do with the money. But I talked to various neighbors and calculated if we just didn't use government money, but used our own money, you know, maybe it would cost us $35,000 to build a walking path. But of course, when you do it federal, you've got all these obligations and conditions. Now, if you looked at the contract, so I asked to look at the contract, we promised to do thousands and thousands of things, both upfront and over time, that we couldn't do because the town doesn't have any staff. You know, the city council members go to the city council meeting once a month. They open the letters and pay the bills, right? There's no staff. So if you read the contract, I can tell you the staff can't do that. Now, they said the development agency in Jackson could do that, you know, but we had to pay them a fee and everything else. Now, they were going to put the walking path on the town commons, which is beautiful. You have this beautiful, green, lush town commons. And what we're going to do is we're going to spend $180,000 pouring cement all over it. Right?
Right.
So I don't know how that works in climate change, but I don't think that's, you know, pouring cement all over the green grass on the town commons. I don't see what that's going to do. Now, I didn't talk to the third neighbor, but I was not planning on using the walking path. And I don't know if the other Solaria team member was, but I didn't see where the, you know, where the usage was going to come in. Now, to get the money for that $180,000, you're either going to have to use taxpayers' money. Remember, this is a county where the average income is $24,000 per person. And, or you're going to have to borrow money by, and the Fed monetizing, which of course, the more the Fed monetizes, the more the, you know, the debt goes up and the inflation gets worse. Now, the town had spent many decades saving enough money. You know, they had a decent reserve that they had been very prudent and saved. To do this $180,000, they were going to have to do some kind of match. I forget how much, but maybe they spend. But it was going to be a sizable portion of our rainy day funds. So what we were describing was basically a make project that was going to waste enormous amounts of money, turn the grass into cement, and create something that the town didn't need, but that would subject the town to massive amounts of, you know, legal restrictions for the next 20 or 30 years. And everybody felt obligated to do it because the state had this huge pot of money, that federal money, that had to be put out. And right. The development agency wanted fees, okay? If the town had taken our match for the federal grant and used that for many different things that would be justified in the private markets, you know, and make sense in terms of real productivity, we would have gotten a much better result. Not to mention, if you're going to spend money on infrastructure, maybe you ought to fix the potholes.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's very important when you're a state legislator and you're looking at how are we going to break this addiction, you need to understand that a lot of that money is there to control, and it's there to create an addiction, and it's the result of basically the central bankers printing free money.
Right, which is the advantage they have over the states.
Right.
So, yeah, my question to you on the state bank is, yeah, how can the state bank increase the budget for the state legislature where they're less reliant on the federal money and can be more
independent? The way to create more money for the state legislature is to do things that help the businesses and farms and people in the state be more profitable, therefore they pay more taxes. In other words,
okay,
you want to do everything you can to drive the GDP up, and that drives the tax take up, because you're driving the GDP up.
Right. So most states just have a law where they have to balance the budget, right? No state has the money printing capability that the Fed has.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And lots of states justify, you know, we do it this way because the Fed will give us money. And you've watched the Fed or the federal government basically finance money into the states or into state institutions in a way that causes the general economy and culture to become less and less and less and less productive. So one of the big issues in the food area is going to be, what do we do about food stamps? Because we have, you know, in a state like Tennessee, you have significant number of people on food stamps. And if you look at how the food stamp programs work, that encourages them to buy food in certain ways, in a way that is less healthy and less productive.
Right. Well, there's actually a part of that program now called Double Bucks. And what that means, I guess, say someone has $50 in food stamps, and if they buy, you know, say produce from a local farmer, that $50 would become $100. I don't know if that's something the state can pass on themselves, or that's a federal option that's there. But yeah, it just seems like a promising way to go about it.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let me jump in and mention another thing. And that's got to do with certificates of good standing and who can do business in the state. If you look at a state contract budget and different functions that are performed for the state, so the asset manager who works for the pension fund, or the bank that holds deposits for the bank, or the Wall Street firm that does underwriting for the bonds that the state sells, or the IT professional who runs their systems or provides various telecommunication services. What you will find is that in many governments around the country, there has been a steady deterioration as corporations get in, get control of these different operations. They get dependent on the corporations, and the corporations do not have integrity. So, in fact, we've just seen, starting with the treasurer of West Virginia, but now a whole group of state AGs, moving to throw BlackRock out of state business. They're saying, why should we put money in the pocket of a company that's doing things that destroys our companies? In other words, they're looking at their contracting budget and their delegation of responsibilities budget and saying, why should we give power to somebody who's destroying our tax base? They're integrating their analysis of GDP across functions. And what they're saying, and I get back to, is the state creating the condition of sovereignty. If the state hires and pays criminals to do state business in a way that impacts the citizens, that destroys sovereignty. And so one thing a state can do is remove from its contract budget, from its asset management money, from its depository and custodian and trustee functions, and all the different functions for different pots of reserve money, or from the underwriting business. It can remove corporations and banks who are acting in other aspects of their business, or in that aspect of their business, in a way that is not in integrity. They also, so now I'm talking about the state operations, but they also have the ability to remove a certificate of good standing, so that company cannot function in that state. They cannot do business in the state.
Okay, so yeah, in a way it's revoking their corporate charter to operate in the state, is what you're saying, right?
Well, it's basically saying, if you're a criminal, you can't function here. You can't operate here.
Right. So it's not just the state. Is it just the state saying, no, we're not going to do business with you anymore?
Or well, there are two steps. The first step is that if the state is doing business, you know, if you're a state and you're highly dependent on an IT contractor to provide all sorts of goods and services, and you pull their certificate of good standing, suddenly they have to walk off the job. So step one is you've got to clean the criminals out of your own contracting budget and other delegation of responsibilities. And as you do that, you ought to say, you know, you shouldn't be able to do business in the state. You know, doing business in our state requires that you do not have an organized crime business model.
Right. So you think that could override any federal attempt to intercede on behalf of the corporation, or just
in theory, it should be able to. Now, it's a political matter, because you're talking, you know, if you take a big bank who has a clear record of systemic criminality,
Right.
And you try and remove them from the state depository or underwriting functions, you know, there's going to be tremendous political pressure. It's one of the reasons why I would love to have a state bank, you know, to make sure that there's someone who can provide liquidity and support the banks in that kind of situation. If the government is going to argue that that bank should be free, so let me step back. We saw banks during the financial crisis protected by arguing that they had essentially sovereign immunity as a systemically important bank.
Right.
I would love to see the state AGs point out that they really don't, that extending BIS sovereign immunity through the Fed to private banks through the systemically important structure is completely outside the Constitution. It's completely outside the law. And absolutely, it makes no absolute sense whatsoever. And those banks need to be stripped of their immunity from criminal prosecution for criminal behavior. I mean, there's $21 trillion missing from federal accounts, and they ran them. And they ran the, right. the New York Fed, which, you know, which is the depository. So I think, you know, the state AGs have all the wherewithal they need to do it as a legal matter. The question is, do they have the support politically of enough people in the population up against a media that is very dirty?
Right. So when it comes to kicking the criminals out of the state, would this be something the legislature would do directly, or would the legislature give the executive branch?
The executive branch, in terms of firing them from the state business, I'm assuming in most states the executive branch has absolutely the power to do that.
Right.
You know, so in the federal government, it's called decaying. Any contractor can be decayed from doing business in the federal, you know, in the federal government budget. And there is a process that DOD used to run, and I'm assuming they still do, where somebody is made eligible to be a federal contractor, and that eligibility can be pulled. So I'm assuming that the executive branch in states probably have the same power of decaying. At the same time, if I were a governor, I wouldn't proceed doing that without consultation of the legislature. One of the reasons is, if you look at the campaign funding, a lot of campaign funding is coming from those companies, banks, and their law firms. So, you know, this needs to be thought through as a political matter, how you're going to do that.
Right. Just one of the things Monsanto did, from what I understand, was they would hire lawyers from all different kinds of firms,
right,
just to cover their bases and just, yeah, give them more clout politically if something did turn into a political dispute.
Right. And well, what you would see is they would outspend. So when I was on Wall Street, we would watch situations where a group of underwriters wanted to get a state or a local agency or a state agency to do a big project that would generate huge bonding deals. And if you look at the stops they would pull out, I mean, the lobbying power, both direct, indirect, formal, informal, that they could, you know, that they could put on any kind of political situation was enormous, and you have to be prepared to handle that.
Right. Here's another question for you with the insurance companies. You know, sometimes what makes it tougher for these smaller producers, even though what they're doing just doesn't have
right.
a history of causing foodborne illness, is the insurance companies will refuse to give them product liability insurance. Like in Florida, Farm Bureau, at least at one time, I don't know if it's still true, wouldn't insure people operating under this 20,000 bird exemption.
So that's a state where a state can step in and provide an insurance reserve function, you know, negotiate with the insurance companies. Okay, what do you need to do it? How are we going to do it? And step in and make sure it's there, and make sure the insurance company, if they do have legitimate concerns, have what they need to do it. So the state can create something that takes the tail risk.
Right. So they could create, say, their own product liability insurance fund where.
Right, but I would make it reinsurance. So I would not want to do Farmers Directly. I'd want to work through the insurance. I mean, so if you look, you know, and I'm prejudiced because my person, I've used the Farm Bureau Insurance Company in Tennessee a lot, but as right. a retail, you know, just as a member individual, and my experience is they are very, very good.
Right.
So now I can't speak. I'm not a farmer. So, but I would say if I was the governor of Tennessee, I'd sit down with Farm Bureau and say, you know, what do you need to do this? And figure out, okay, how do we post a reinsurance reserve that can protect them so that if they do get hit above, you know, an economic level, we backstop. I don't know yeah. enough about the laws and the particulars of this situation, but I would want to first figure out how to solve the insurance company's problems. Now, if they're just controlling centrally and engineering the central control, that's different. But, you know, I think we're at the point where, you know, we now have reached a state, Pete, where enough people, whether legislators or citizens, realize that there's a control game going on and they're printing money out of thin air to engineer it. And people are ready to push back.
Yeah, because just what's going on with the insurance game is you get a lot of people who are capable of being good producers, but they think if they can't get product liability insurance, they just have too much.
Right. And that's legitimate, but I think that's a problem that a state can solve.
Okay.
I really right. believe that's, and that's worse. If you have a state bank and a state depository, a state bank can help facilitate the process of figuring that out. You know, and maybe they administer a reinsurance capacity, or maybe they don't, but they can facilitate identifying. So there are thousands of little things in terms of regulation of circulating venture capital. So, you know, in my little town in Tennessee, you know, I can take all my savings and spend it on lottery tickets. But if I try and finance my neighbor's business, I can go to jail. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So there's thousands of these little rules in terms of venture capital and equity that can get fixed, you know, and make sure that there's a liquid market. And, you know, and it's worth the brain damage of sitting down and deleting every one of them, you know, and it's thousands of tiny little things, as
well,
you know.
Yeah, just how with food, it's how do you keep more of the food dollar in the state right now?
Okay.
Because just.
So let me tell you the marketing opportunity for a state legislature. I'm working with one person we're considering writing a big report on synthetic food, or sponsoring mm-hmm. a big report on synthetic food. The issue now is not what is the price of local food. The issue now is if you don't have local food, you won't have real food. Because now you're
right.
talking about synthetic, you know, if I can buy from a farmer locally, I'm going to get real food. If I go to the store, I don't know what's in it. And, you know, you did a wonderful thing on labeling, so we don't have to repeat it here. But we don't know what's in it and where it comes from. I don't care, you know, all the tracking they can do. And we don't know that it's safe.
Right. Well, I'll give you a perfect example of that. One of these things that is just where the government doesn't go by the precautionary principle anymore are these nanoparticles in food.
Right.
There have been reports from both the U.S. and Europe, you know, hundreds if not thousands of products they tested had nanoparticles
right.
in food. And at this food safety conference I went to earlier in the month, there's this one university, I guess, that had a couple people do experiments on nanoparticles on lettuce, and they found it was very difficult to clean off. And
right.
they said just the nanoparticles can cause kidney damage. They can cause
right.
Liver damage.
They can kill you.
Yeah. Even organic foods in this country right now
right.
can have nanoparticles in them. They don't test organic for nanoparticles.
Right.
So you just have this situation where you have to go to a local source if you really want to be assured of quality.
So this, one of the scariest food series we ever did was before you took it over, Pete. Harry Blaser interviewed a retired professor from Purdue, and he described the mystery ingredients in food that they were finding. Scariest thing I've ever heard in my life. And the guy had his career had started in military intelligence, and you could tell he was afraid to, like, but Harry kept poking him and getting it out of him, and you listen to it and it's frightening. So if you're a state legislator, the question is, you know, not can you make this economic? The question is, if you don't do this, the state, you know, the citizens of your state will not have real food.
Right. Well, and you know, people we're always looking for a court to find a fundamental right to obtain the foods of your choice from the source of your choice.
Right.
And some people use, I don't know if you've heard of these private membership associations.
Right.
Some people use that. And when you really look at the history of the court rulings, the Supreme Court rulings on the freedom of association, they haven't gotten to that point yet. But there's also a fundamental right to parents to have the custody and care of their children.
Right.
And what's more important to care than just a solid nutrition? So
right.
I think there is a constitutional right. And I think what's happening is politics plays a part in all of this. And as you've mentioned many times, the great poisoning, as this continues to accelerate, if a court doesn't rule on it, I think the regulators are much more likely to leave people alone.
Right.
Who are just doing whatever they can to find the best food when there are so many mystery foods in the grocery
right.
stores and the supermarkets now.
One of the asset managers I worked with long ago told me a story of several asset managers who were looking at investing in this food space, were learning more and more of what was going on. And they finally, this was in Europe, they finally just said, you know something, we're going to get together. We're going to hire a farming family from Eastern Europe. We're going to bring them over here, and we're going to have them start a farm that just grows all of our food. That's it. We give up. It's cheaper. It's better. It's safer. And I remember going to a food conference in Vermont where a young couple had started a farm, and they were providing food for all these families on a cost-plus basis. They would just, you know, get the food. They would make the food. Then they would give them a bill for whatever it cost them, plus a built-in profit, cost plus, just like government contracts. And it, you know, it was the same thing. The families just wanted to be assured of high-quality, safe food.
Right. I wish someone would just do a survey on take a group of people who get most of their food from the farm versus most of the people who go to the supermarket, and just compare the demand for resources in the medical system with each of those two groups. I just don't think it would be close.
Like Paul Thomas, he was the guy who did a study on all the people in his practice, all the kids. And he did a comparison over many years between the fully vaccinated, the partially vaccinated, and the unvaccinated. And it was just dramatic to see the difference.
Right. And I think it would be the same thing with food. It's not that this food is risky. It's just the opposite. It's just that the laws favor the industrial system right now.
Right. So let me keep going. I got another one on the financial side, which relates
okay.
to telecommunications. And that is, if you look at the telecommunications system, there's many things about it that does not have integrity. So we have a one-way surveillance mirror that has put small business at a huge disadvantage. And we have the sort of absence of good encryption at the local level. And I believe we have entrainment subliminal programming. And I think over time, there's a lot a state can do to allow citizens and encourage citizens to build their own encryption systems and have telecommunications, which are local and independent, you know, and can perform, but are not allowing monopolies for big telecommunications companies that have a history of censorship, you know, sneaky sabotage, censorship, and really criminal activity. I mean, I've dealt with a couple of telecommunication companies that I think are about the worst in the world, and they are constantly censoring people by throttling systems, by emails never getting through, on and on and on. And so, you know, cleaning up the quality and performance of the telecommunication systems, I think, are essential to operating any business, including farms. So if you if your competitors are listening to everything you do and say, and can listen to all your customers and influence them in sneaky ways, you know, you're going to lose market share. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. So do you think this, again, does this come more from the legislature, state legislature passing a particular bill?
I think this has to come from the legislature, but I think you need a real joint effort by the executive branch and the legislature working together, because the first thing you're going to have to do is clean them out of your own telecommunication systems.
Right.
Right. And,
yeah.
And I would not, if I was a state, I would not be afraid of creating an in-state telecommunications business to do the state's business that's owned by the state. You can, you know, that would be a great business. You start a state telecommunications business, float half the stock to the citizens, you know, in-state citizens, and then you, you know, you have the state or the pension funds own, you know, a controlling interest, and it provides telecommunications to the state. But you have a whole bunch of experts who are now on your payroll who are paid to keep the state telecommunications system clean and make sure none of the private telecommunication companies acting in the state are doing anything untoward. Because, you know, it's hard for non-experts to deal with this because it's invisible and sophisticated technology. But
right.
I think an in-state telecommunications utility that makes sure the whole infrastructure is clean would be fantastic. And it would help all small business, including farms.
Yeah. Have you seen any example of that anywhere? Is there any, like, even pilot project?
No, all I see is the worst behavior by the telecommunications company just rolling every community in the country. And don't think it's not connected to what we've just lived through for the last 2 years. You know, if you look at the control grid, there are three lines. The first is the digital systems, including the telecommunications, and that includes the entrainment and the surveillance. Then the second is the financial nuts and bolts. And then the third is covert operations. So what you and I are talking about now, you know, we're talking about the food nuts and our finance nuts and bolts. And now we're talking about the surveillance and telecommunications. So now, if you look at the controllers, they're trying to add control of the food system, and they've been sneaking up it for years, and you've been trying to stop them for years. And now with the food shortages and these big changes, they're really looking to get complete control and feed people synthetic food.
Right. Well, what they've done is they've driven more people into the local food system.
Right.
The last couple of years. So right. It's just, are there enough food producers out there to meet the demand, and is the infrastructure sufficient to meet the demand too? So that's where the state legislature can really come in.
Right. And getting back to the Sheriff of Nottingham, we're going to have to protect the food producers, you know, from the covert operations. So I remember when I was driving around the country, the farmers were furious at you-know-who moving in to try and get the legislatures to approve Terminator seeds. But they swore to me that, you know, guys in black vans were showing up to beat up farmers who wouldn't play ball.
Well, Maine just this last year passed a constitutional right to food amendment, which, among other things, protected the right to save and exchange seed.
Right. And you did a great interview, and that's in the food series.
Right. And yeah, and that's something, yeah, you definitely need. I mean, the other thing we've noticed is just how well over half the country is suffering through a drought right now.
Right.
And I've looked, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of these weather modification laws that the state has. So acknowledging man does have the power to manipulate the weather. So just, yeah, that's another thing the state can do and put is just these weather modification, put some teeth in them so they can actively try if someone is trying to engineer a drought or there is a drought anyway, try and do something about it. Because Texas alone has over 100 laws that reference weather modification.
Right. Well, we all know that for the Olympics, the Chinese said, don't worry, we'll make sure there's no, you know, the weather's fine.
Right.
And it was really funny because, you know, Dr. Skidmore did this fabulous sort of review and bibliography of all the literature on weather modification. And when I first met him and he said, how can $21 trillion be missing? Sorry, we have many. You know, it's funny. So right now I'm all the way, the western part of Switzerland. And everywhere I've gone on this trip, so I was in Bavaria and Lake Constance, and then yesterday I was in Munich, now I'm in Arlesheim, which is outside of Dornach, where the Steiner Gerding Atom is. Everywhere I go, people say all summer long, they're just constant ambulances. Just constant ambulances.
Yeah.
We're getting it here. Sorry about the noise.
Yeah. But the... what this has done is just one of the things. Joel Saladin had an interview with RFK last week. And one of the things he mentioned was, RFK brought up all the problems farmers are having getting fertilizer. And he was just saying, well, just with the kind of farming you do, you provide more of your own inputs.
Right.
So it's not as big an issue. So you've got these.
They force you to get rid of all your cows.
Well, and just with a drought, you know, instead of them being able to feed on grass, you have to bring in hay if you can find it. You have to bring your inputs.
So
in.
I was telling Skidmore, about weather warfare, and he didn't believe me. So I made him go to the Beijing Weather Modification Office and look at what the Chinese were saying and doing. And he realized, oh my God, this stuff is really happening. And so he did this huge review of all the literature on weather warfare and realized, oh, this is really going on. And I think the big issue, I don't know if you saw the Canadian premier during COVID who was asked about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, ducked the question and went into marketing the vaccines, then felt bad and started to say, well, I want to thank the people who sent the rain. Without rain, you know, we can't, you know, the farmers won't succeed. And if the farmers don't succeed, we're all sunk. And everybody was looking at him like, what is he talking about? And I think what he was talking about was they're being blackmailed if they don't, you know, if they don't promote the vaccinations and achieve a certain quota on the vaccination, you know, their rain will be cut off.
Right. Do you think this is something the attorney general, the different state attorney generals would be able to do something about?
Yep. And so that leads us to taxation. You ready to start on taxation?
All right, fire away.
Okay. So, and I just want to say to everybody, we wrote a piece on this and you can get it at ourmoney.solari.com/taxation. It's public. So we made the taxation wrap up public so that, you know, we could have the public policy conversation. The biggest economic problem in any state is that the citizens are paying taxes to the federal government. And then the federal government is using that money in ways that are, number one, outside the law, and number two, raise the expenses to everybody in the state, including the state government, and do things that destroy their businesses. Now,
right.
You know, it's like if I had a tapeworm in my body and I kept taking my resources and used it to feed the tapeworm and make the tapeworm stronger, and the tapeworm keeps making me weaker, and then I get more and more dependent on the injections from the tapeworm. The way a tapeworm makes you eat what it wants is injects chemical in your body that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm. So we're in this cycle with the government money where we're constantly getting weaker by feeding a tapeworm, and they're using that money in illegal ways. So what I believe a state AG could do, and we describe this at length in taxation, is they could help citizens do a series of potential things against the banks who I think are responsible for the $21 trillion missing, or put their taxes in escrows and ensure that the expenditures are all legal under the Constitution and the financial management laws.
So how could they operate against the banks? What could they do using that option?
What I did was I operated against, and you know, I took the, I owed one New York Fed member bank $14,000. And I, at the time, the missing money was $14,000 per person. And I wrote them a letter and said, I'm asserting a common law right of offset. I owe you $14,000, but you owe me $14,000. You know, and so I'm asserting a common law right of offset. I don't owe you anything.
Right.
So you won't pay me and I won't pay you. And if you've got a problem, here's my attorney's name and address. And, you know, feel free to call her and we can negotiate or litigate, you know, whatever you want. But I'm not paying.
Well, yeah, we've seen what the banks have done to farmers over the years, convince them they need to upgrade their equipment and all that, and just borrow more money and then pull the plug once they have.
Right.
By, yeah, raising interest rates. So I think a critical part of this is whether it's coming from these community banks or direct from the state legislature is just grants instead of loans to just improve the local infrastructure, or direct grants to farmers who have a chance to be productive. Alaska had they passed a bill this last year, which established a forgivable loan program where someone could borrow up to $150,000, a farmer could, or someone who wanted to put up a local slaughterhouse could. And if the state saw progress was being made, the farmer was making more sales, production was going up, they could forgive the loan. So,
well, but I would love to see something where you make it easier for a farmer's community or customers to crowdfund or do equity deals that invest. And maybe the state, you know, funds it, but it brings a private market integrity to it.
Right.
So it keeps it healthy and everybody's invested. You know, I love it when the customers finance a farmer because they're invested in that farmer being profitable and successful.
So Congress passed this federal JUMP Act. I think that's what it was called, the JUMP Act 10 years ago, just trying to raise money through crowdfunding for businesses. Has that been that effective in your opinion? Or?
Not that I know of, but Pete, I honestly haven't tracked it. We did a whole bunch of publications on crowdfunding, and we did a great piece on the state. We did a great piece on sort of the states that were applying crowdfunding and allowing it to be used for equity investment. And those are all in the library. But we, since then, we haven't tracked it. We didn't, you know, most of what was happening was so cumbersome and there was so much central banking money being thrown top down that I didn't see it go somewhere. And I think it wasn't until COVID that I saw a significant number of financially secure people realizing, oh, if I keep financing the companies that are destroying my world and I don't finance the farmers and local energy companies I need to have a decent life, you know, I'm going to be in trouble. That's a new, you know, that's a big change and that's just happened.
There's just the way the state infrastructure is set up right now is for the export of food. It's just in most states. Most states, state residents probably consume, put it this way, in most states, I would say less than 10% of the food state residents consume is produced in the state. So it's just changing that infrastructure around to encourage Production more within the state as opposed to just having it, whether it's foreign countries or other states, just taking up much of, just having outside entities being responsible for the food dollar. Because I think Florida has maybe 20% of the food Florida residents consume is produced in the state, and that's a pretty high number. There aren't many states
like
that.
Yeah, but it's much lower than it used to be.
Probably.
Right. Right, it's much lower than it used to be. It's interesting, you know, since I've been in the Netherlands, I've been using a service that's fabulous called Hofweb, where you go online, you choose, and it's all sort of organic and biodynamic and local farmers, and they deliver mostly throughout the Netherlands. And you order all your food, and then on Wednesday or Friday, they bring it in these crates that are recyclable. You know, so each week you put out the crates from last week and you get everything. And the quality of the food is unbelievable. It's just fantastic. And it comes right to your door. It's delivery right to your door. And that delivery makes an enormous difference.
Well, Catherine, I think it makes an even bigger difference in America, because I think American consumers are more known than most other consumers in most other countries for liking convenience. So I think we've seen is Joel Saladin is an example of this. And until a few years ago, he'd only ship within 100 miles of his farm. And now more and more of these farmers are shipping all over the country right now. The downside to that, like we talked about, is that they have this big electronic record where, you know, you'd rather have people paying cash, buying locally. So I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you was, when you're trying to get people to accept this local currency and say it's the, it's what you and Franklin Sanders worked on, the gold and silver dollar calculator to figure out what the local currency would be in terms of gold and silver coins. Yeah, what can you do to convince people to use that currency more than the U.S. Currency?
I think that's a big thing, because anything, you know, Tennessee just dropped the sales tax on precious metals. So anything the state can do to make it possible for us to use gold and silver as a currency, you know, is wonderful. Particularly because if we have a state depository, we can just put the gold and silver in the state depository and just send around chits. Especially if we have our own encryption systems, you know, then it gets really fun. So anything you can do in the state tax system to reduce anything that stops the liquidity of using gold and silver, because they can't, you know, under the Constitution, they can't stop that.
Right. Well, what I was thinking of was these, you know, the governments will say if you pay your property tax 3 months early before the deadline, you know, we'll give you 1%, 2%, 3% off or something like that on your property tax. Maybe. What do you think of just having an incentive? If you pay in our local currency, the gold and silver currency, we'll give you a discount.
So I think that's a fantastic idea. And I'll tell you why. If a state decides in its rainy day funds or in its pension funds, we're going to start to accumulate gold and silver. And they do it that way. If you look at the fees and transaction costs of, you know, going out in the market and buying bullion, if they just over time accumulate the way you describe, not only do they help kickstart the market, but it's going to be a very economic way for them to accumulate gold and silver over time, which for their rainy day reserve fund is a fabulous investment for them.
Yeah, and maybe there'd be a way they could do it with a sales tax too in the states. Like I think in Tennessee, for instance, I think there's a sales tax on most foods. If the vendors paid, you know, the government in with gold and silver with a sales tax, maybe they could cut something off of that.
Right. Well, I think the more we can create liquidity, you know, and the reason I love gold and silver is you just do it. You just start doing it. You don't need to have an organization. You don't need to have a board. You don't need to come up with a plan for community currency. And I think you and I both know, Pete, if you look at what they're trying to do with central control, we're either going to start our own community currency and credit systems, or we're going to be slaves. So my attitude is, of course, we can figure it out.
Right. Yeah.
It's easier than the alternative.
It goes in with the, it's the food and the money and the healthcare. Though I think those are just the big three. I mean, I do a little bit of work on like vaccine mandate bills for Weston Price, just editing alerts and things like that. But somehow it would be great to bring, if the states could put the money toward, say, establish like a homeopathic hospital, things like right. that, in one time this country, and just try and...
We can all save a fortune on healthcare if we don't run the naturopaths out.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So let me bring up another one that is not going to sound like money, but it's very important to the money, and that is the Second Amendment. So it's very important that a state is strong on Second Amendment. So in 2020, the number one drop off for U-Haul nationally was in Nashville. And I had John Harris, who's the president of the Tennessee Firearms Association, of which I've been a member longstanding for many, many years. And I said, you know, every real estate broker in Tennessee owes you a kickback.
Right.
Because, you know, I'll be blunt. If you look at where I live, you know, the sheriff can't get there for 20 to 45 minutes. And you know, we face potential for, drug gangs doing home invasions. It's happened before. And one of the reasons we're safe is because everybody is extremely well armed and trained.
Right. And well, you've mentioned it in some of these cities like Chicago, where just, there's all kinds of crime right now. It just seems like they're not making the effort to stop it. They could. It's going to drive people out. Then, the billionaires are going to come in and buy up the real estate cheap.
Right. It's a way of getting the real estate cheap. You know, and defunding the police is a way of getting the real estate cheap. So,
right.
So to me, you know, one of the things, back to the Sheriff of Nottingham, you know, citizens who are well armed are protected from the Sheriff of Nottingham. So I think having a state legislature that's very strong in the Second Amendment is exceptionally important.
Well, yeah. I know Tennessee, when the Brady Bill was passed, I think Frank Nicely said they voted not to spend state dollars enforcing that. If the federal government wanted to come and enforce it, that was up to them, but the state wasn't going to enforce it.
Right.
So, there are a number of different things. They're more, I think at one time, the only state that might have had an open carry law was Vermont.
Uh-huh.
Now a number of states have them. So I think they see the writing on the wall.
So the last thing I want to bring up, every 4 years I go into a bad mood because I watch wonderful American citizens waste a huge amount of time on the presidential election while they ignore their state and local elections. And what I know you know is that a great state legislature can make a huge difference. So you did an interview with Senator Frank Nicely of Tennessee on the Salier Report. He's been the hero of the week, I think, several times. You know what a difference a great state legislator can make. It's incredible.
Right.
You know, he was part of getting the law passed for ivermectin to be available in the state. I mean, that saves lives. So what can we do today to inspire people to figure out who their state legislature is, their great state legislator is, and support them?
Well, I think the good news is in many states, it just doesn't take all that many people to pass a bill. If you get a champion like Frank Nicely in the legislature, who knows how to move things through and is highly respected, can happen. You know, Tom Massey, who you've honored a number of times as a hero too, he just said if even on a federal bill, if you get 10 calls into the office, that might be enough to convince the legislator to sponsor the bill. So just you can contact Weston Price if you're interested in working on a state bill, whether it's a food bill or a health bill. I mean, there are a number of these health bills called safe harbor bills, which states are passing now, which deregulate homeopaths, naturopaths, like you said, so they don't. Yeah.
So let me make an offer. So if you're a Soleri Report subscriber and you're listening to this and you want to send a copy of the taxation wrap-up to your state legislator, if you will write your state legislator a letter and mail it to us at the Soleri office in Hickory Valley, we'll add a wrap-up at our own expense and mail it to them.
Yeah. I'll tell you something else, Catherine. At least with the food, we've noticed in most states, it's better to preempt the local level and put the power at the state level. Because with food, and a lot of times you'll get these localities with this attitude, the NIMBY, my backyard attitude. And when really it's...
Well, but it's a lot easier for a big corporation to come in and buy a few guys locally, and you want to avoid that. I think the state is subject to more transparency and more, you know, they have more good governance infrastructure in a good state.
And it's also like you were alluding to earlier, if the more things you do right as far as promoting business, having a strong Second Amendment, the more money you're going to have in the state coffers.
Right.
Tennessee has cut taxes a number of times, I think the last 20 years, and they've got a, from what I understand, a fairly substantial surplus right now.
Right. So, you know, if you can find a state that's willing to do all of this in one package, we'll just call it reversing the great poisoning.
Right. Well, it's just if you get a legislator like Frank Nicely, I mean, his vision of the way the state should be goes beyond food. I mean, he's
absolutely.
Yeah, he introduced a bill this last session that would have the state legislators pick the candidates for U.S. Senate. You know, the you have to elect them directly with the 17th Amendment, but it doesn't mean the states can't. And the truth is, just with all the baloney you get from the mainstream media, the state's legislators have a much better idea of what's going on than the common voter.
No, I agree with that. So let me, one other thing I wanted to suggest is if you look at what is happening now with the state AGs going against BlackRock and the treasurer of West Virginia, it's almost as though there's a crack in the matrix. And the states are really, you know, I had a discussion with a group who are working to improve things in Tennessee. And they kept talking about, you know, food and money, food and money. I said, look, we don't have a food problem. We don't have a money problem. We have a sovereignty problem.
Right.
And either the state government can help us create the conditions of sovereignty and protect within that the rule of law. You know, what citizens need is a level playing field where they can perform. They need to, they need to be free to be productive. And if they are productive and create wealth, they need to be able to not have the Sheriff of Nottingham steal it.
And, yeah.
And so our problem is governance, and the state solution is to provide sufficient governance so that in these different areas of food and money, you know, and no covert operations, we can perform, but it's our job to be productive and perform.
Right. The state legislators can give you the opportunity to succeed. Just set up a framework of laws where you can succeed, and that's what you want them to do.
Right, but we're going to have to go out and succeed. We're going to have to work hard.
Right. Well, you just see it with food. just when they deregulate, you get many more local producers online. It keeps more the dollar in the community, makes the community more self-sufficient in food production, and just it's all good.
So I will say this, I know it's complicated both in the food and the money area, but let's just pretend for a second we weren't up against this enormous force field trying to run everything centrally. You know, the opportunity, if the food systems could work successfully and the money systems could work successfully, the opportunity to make things work and build wealth is fantastic. That's the secret sauce here. I mean, if you look at the cost of tyranny, it's unbelievably expensive.
Well, I know you pointed out this in Money and Markets with John Titus a number of times. It's amazing with all the theft and that's going on right now that people are still being as successful as they are.
It's unbelievable. Shows,
yeah, the work ethic and will to succeed is there.
Right. It's Chuck Lorre had a great quote about it. I should find it from the library, but he called it the great momentum. And no matter how much they stole and destroyed, you know, they couldn't stop the fact that most people had to get up in the morning and be useful all day to, you know, to pay their rent.
Well, yeah, when you look at who's provided the jobs, small business in the Fortune 500, there's no comparison.
Right, right.
So,
okay, well, yeah. I want everybody to go check out food.solari.com. Every time Pete does a show, we add it there. And there's an incredible library going back years of great interviews that are still very, very timely today. And of course, you're doing new ones every, you know, almost every month, Pete. I can't wait to see the report on are you going to do a report on the safety conference?
Yeah, well, I've done a draft of the report on the food safety conference. So, yeah, the centralization team is pretty active there.
Yeah, they're busy. So. They're busy at work. Did you hear the interview we did with Scott Tips on Codex? That's another way they're coming. Yeah, that's another way they're coming. Okay, well, Pete Kennedy, I can't thank you enough for doing this. And let us have your ideas. We want to help you help your state legislators get going and really make some progress state by state. And, you know, we tend to talk about the United States, but there's tremendous similarities throughout the Western world. So, you know, this war is going to be won or lost in the trenches. You know, I'm always saying freedom and control happen one person at a time. But if you have ideas on how Pete and I can help your state legislators or the Solari team, we want to hear about it because we want to give them as much information and ideas and intelligence as possible to support their efforts in protecting us all from the Sheriff of Nottingham. Anything you want to add, Pete?
Well, no, you make progress going about it this way one state at a time, but I just think states like Tennessee and Florida in many respects have set the bar. So, this can happen anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
It can. I would never have, if you had asked me who would have come out on top on COVID, I would never have bet Florida, but look at what they've done. It's incredible.
Well, yeah, DeSantis came so close to losing the election 4 years ago, but thankfully he won, and he's, just done a great job pushing back against pharma.
Well, it's funny. I used to, Pete, always tell people how important it was to vote in the state and the local elections and what a difference it made to their lives. And I can't tell you how many people who poo-pooed the importance of jurisdiction. You know, if you were in a state where all the small businesses got wiped, you're looking at Florida and saying, and the people I know in Florida who have small businesses or practices are just like, thank God I live in Florida.
Right.
Right.
And yeah, just, you know, last I heard we had 1,000 people a day moving into this state. So
Pete's in Florida.
Yeah, that's right. People are voting with their feet. Same thing with Tennessee.
Right. Right. I talked to one guy, I'll never forget, last year in, he's over on the West Coast, and he said, oh, my God, every day there are more Illinois and New York license plates. They're just pouring in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, New York here, they used to mainly go down to like the East Coast, but the New Yorkers are moving everywhere. They're buying
pouring in.
Yep.
Okay, well, Pete Kennedy, thank you for joining me on the Solari Report again, ladies and gentlemen. If we can help you support and encourage your great state legislators, let us know, and we'll do what we can. So, again, thank you for joining me on the Solari Report.
Well, thanks, Catherine. Appreciative you had me on.